everyone gathered around the television to watch the special about Vietnam. And then they showed the chopper landing. You could hear bullets flying, so the Viet Cong were there, and them jumping out, tying a rope on the legs of two American soldiers and dragging them to the helicopter. I didn't know that was my brother until the announcer said, "We have recovered the bodies of." And at that point, my mother, it was a wail, it was a cry that you never want to hear.
Her brother, James Gabriel Jr., was the first Native Hawaiian soldier killed in action during the Vietnam War. 5 decades later, she continues to honor his sacrifice. Billy Gabriel, next on Long Story Short.
Long Story Short with Leslie Wilcox is Hawaii's first weekly television program produced and broadcast in high definition.
Aloha mai kākou. I'm Leslie Wilcox. Billy Gabriel of Honolulu lost her older brother James Kimo Gabriel Jr. to the Vietnam War in 1962. Not only was her brother the first Native Hawaiian soldier to be killed in action, but also one of the first U.S. Special Forces soldiers to make the ultimate sacrifice in Vietnam. 4 years later, Sergeant Barry Sadler released the song The Ballad of the Green Berets. The original lyrics were written to pay tribute to James Gabriel Jr. In 2010, Billy Gabriel used her public relations contacts and experience to spearhead the Hawaii Call for Photos project. She tracked down photographs of 276 Hawaii soldiers who lost their lives during the Vietnam War. The plan is to display photos from across the nation in an education center to be built in Washington, D.C. Billy Gabriel read the letters from her late brother, hoping to gain an understanding of his views on Vietnam. What she found brought her closer to the big brother who died when she was just 11 years old.
There's a lot of Hawaiian in your blood, in your brother's blood.
Yes, my mother is pure Hawaiian. My father is half Hawaiian and half Filipino. So yes, there's a lot of Kanaka in us. There is. And there were 9 of us. And my father was quite the disciplinarian, very old school. It was his way or his way.
Was he affectionate?
He was not. My father was not. He was very stern, hard worker, perfectionist, and he expected the same out of his children. My father was a voracious reader. He would make me read the dictionary with him. That's what I had to do, read the dictionary, and every week I had to randomly choose a word, and I was told that I needed to use that word in conversation with him for the entire week. And my mother, on the other hand, she was a very humble, giving, loving local girl from Wailua. When she was going to the 8th grade, my tutu pulled her out of school and told her, "From now on, your classroom will be our lo'i, the ocean, and my kitchen." So she never went past 8th grade. But that became her schooling. And she may not have, like my father, been a voracious reader or loved words.
But
her family and her home, that was her life. So she was the balance in our home. She filled that part that gave us the softness.
9 kids, that must have been a hard household to support.
It was. And you know, when I grew up in Palama, proud to say that I'm a product of Marite housing. And when I tell people that, either it raises an eyebrow or they laugh because they can't imagine, or you grew up in the projects, mm-hmm. You know. And I thought, well, back in the 50s, Marite housing is not what it, you know, back then, families, they manicured their lawns. They took care of, watched the other kids. If you did something wrong, you know, auntie would come pull your ear and take you home, and then you would get double spankings, you know, for doing something
wrong. And your father was working?
He was working. My father was with the Royal Hawaiian Band, and he managed all of their engagements and their travel and everything. My mother was a homemaker, stay-at-home mom, and she was there for the family. We always, you know, came home. There's always something on the stove. We never knew that we were low income.
Because you felt like you had enough?
We had enough, and we were happy.
I think you've said that your mother, she never yelled and she never complained. And I find that so hard to believe, having been a mother myself.
Me as well. She never raised her voice. She never did. And
with nine kids?
With nine kids. She didn't, because my father ruled with an iron fist.
No, I think you were seven in the among the nine children.
I was a seventh among them, yes.
And what was your brother? Chemo.
He was the first. So there's a 13-year difference between chemo and myself. So really the only thing I remember is he was the brother who taught me how to spit shine my shoes. So whenever I, you know, do that, I think about him. But, you know, he was always in his ROTC uniform, just looked immaculate. I remember him being happy-go-lucky, always having his ukulele, and singing a lot, joking, loved, always hugging my mother. Always, hi, sweetheart. You know, just very loving.
But love the ROTC program at Farrington High School.
Yes, yes. And I believe that that's where, for him, a seed was planted about serving your country, was in the ROTC.
Did he talk about joining the military after high school?
He talked to my parents about that, you know, and they both said, if that's what you want, you know, we'll support you.
In 1956, James Chemo Gabriel Jr. enlisted in the U.S. Army right after graduating from Farrington High in Kalihi. He excelled in the Army and qualified for the elite U.S. Special Forces, also known as the Green Berets. In 1961, Chemo was sent to Vietnam as an advisor to train local civilians who were recruited to serve in the South Vietnamese Army. That meant teaching those villagers to fight North Vietnam's experienced regular army, as well as the elusive Viet Cong guerrillas in the South.
He would write to my mother every 2 weeks, because I still have her letters. And when I look at the date, every 2 weeks he would write to her.
And what did he write?
When he was in basic training, he'd write about, you know, how the boys, the Hawaiian boys, they were just joking, playing jokes on each other, and how they missed the Hawaiian food.
To have succeeded in Special Forces, he must have been quite the person. I mean, that's something most soldiers don't want to do or are unable to do.
He was very focused. So he, from my father, I believe, he got those traits of being focused, setting your mind on doing something almost to perfection. And he really did want to, my mother said, become a Special Forces soldier.
Your brother entered the Army before the war began. Had his feelings about the war, about his service, changed over that time, I wonder?
Once he got to Vietnam?
Mm-hmm.
I could see the transition in his letters. The earlier letters would talk about, we're here training, I can't tell you what I'm doing, but we're preparing for something big. But even he didn't quite know. So he would talk about things that they were doing. He'd also talk about the jungle, the conditions in the jungle, or the weather, how bad it was there, and that there were these giant ants and leeches. And local boys, we don't know what leeches are. We see slugs on the ground, but you don't see leeches. And so he would say these leeches would attach themselves on you, and they would expand
with your blood.
As they suck out your blood. And you can't hit them off because you're in the jungle and you don't want the Viet Cong to hear you, to see you, any kind of movement. And the last few letters were really about not just conditions, but I remember one in particular where he told my mother, he said, when I'm in a quiet place, I ask myself, what am I doing in this hellhole? These people don't want us here. Sometimes I wish I could trade places and be home. And he says, but then again, I realize I need to be here. Better me than my brothers or others. I'm here to fight for all of you.
close to the time he died, he sent something. He enclosed something in a letter to your mother.
Mm-hmm. He enclosed the Green Beret Creed. So I read the creed. And it's almost like he knew that he was preparing himself. He knew that I may not get out of this.
And in the creed, I believe it says, you know, even if I'm the last, I'll keep, you know, I'll keep fighting till the end.
Yes, yes.
And that's my profession, and I'm a consummate professional.
Yes, exactly.
It probably took you a while to find out what did happen to him in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Are you able to tell that story?
Times had a magazine article that was written in 1962, and the title of it is "We Are Overrun," and in that they chronicle what had happened. But what I read then and what I just learned about a month ago, two different stories.
Okay, tell us the difference.
Well, the first story that I've been led to believe for 40 years has been that there were four special forces that were advisors. And they're among the first special forces sent there. And the advisors go there to train the villagers how to fight. And so he was in a platoon of four. And what I read was that their camp was overrun and that my brother and Sergeant Marchand were the only two who were injured. And that the other two special forces soldiers were forced to carry them into the jungle to run to so that the U.S. troops weren't going to come back there and find the Viet Cong. I was led to believe that they carried them into the jungle, and they were too heavy. They were slowing them down, so they were told to just leave my brother and Marchand there, and the Viet Cong executed them. Tied both their hands behind their backs with their T-shirts and shot them in the back of their head. That's what I have led to believe all these years. And just recently learned that two of the four special forces, they were down at the river. So they had left the camp, went down to the river.
This is before the fighting began?
Before the fighting began. Okay. They went down to the river to bathe. So that left Marchand and my brother there. And they heard the sound of these tocsin bells, like bamboo bells. So he sent up flares to see if they could see who was out there in the jungle. They were just ambushed at that time, while the other two were still down the river. So that left two men fighting about 50 Viet Cong guerrillas who were coming in. But the signal came from someone in the camp that these four special forces were training. So what I've learned is they plant villagers in the camp to serve as spies. And they relayed to the Viet Cong, here's where we are positioned here. We're going to be moving here. Now's the time to attack. I'd never known that there were only two in that camp when they were killed. Now I understand why my brother's last words were, we are running, we have run out of ammunition, we're being overrun. So he was, from what I understand, they said that he was changing clips. He had already been shot twice, changing clips, shooting on the phone, calling for backup.
What do you remember about it the day you heard?
It is almost like yesterday when I think about it, and I shared the story with people, and I was 11, and this was in 1962, and my mother and I, we were in the garage doing chores. She was hanging clothes, and I was, you know, outside doing my chores. And this black bird, this alala, flew into our garage and just fluttered up in the garage in the ceiling. And I looked at it, my mother looked at it, and it looked like she was in distress. And my mother told me, "A'oleho'opa imanu," don't touch the bird. So I ran in the house and came out with a bowl of water. And when I came out, my mother was sitting on the ground with the bird in her lap. And she was stroking the bird, and the bird died in her lap. And she said, she looked at me, she said, tomorrow we will have visitors. I had no idea how connected she was to our Amakua, Ho'ailona. Even I was not exposed to that at that age yet.
So she knew at that point.
She knew at that point. She felt that this was my brother coming to her to say goodbye. So the next day I was at school, and my brother and I were pulled out of class and told we needed to go home. So when we got home, parked in front of our car, in front of our home was an unfamiliar car. So I thought, they must be the visitors my mom talked about.
Because she didn't explain further at that time.
Did not.
Okay.
Did not. So from there, the alala was a ho'ailona to prepare her.
And what does ho'ailona mean?
Ho'ailona is a sign. Is a sign. Hawaiian culture, we believe that our amakua, our spirits, come in different forms, our ancestors. Whether it could be a good sign, it could just be an omen of something to come. So I knew that she felt that alala was her visitor carrying a message. But I didn't expect that they came to tell her that he had been killed. I thought maybe to say that he was coming home or something. And when I walked in, and my mother was just crying.
Did your dad cry?
That was a, you know, that really is one of the only times I did see my father cry.
James Kimo Gabriel Jr. was awarded a Bronze Star for valor and a Purple Heart. At the time of his death, Kimo's wife, who was living in Okinawa, was expecting their first child. Later, the Gabriel family would welcome her to Hawaii along with James Gabriel III, the son Kimo never saw. In 1963, Kimo's remains were recovered from Vietnam, and he was buried at the National Memorial Cemetery of the Pacific at Punchbowl.
And his wife, who was Japanese.
Japan National?
Japan National. Well, he met her in Okinawa. And so when he passed, she was 6 months pregnant. So she came here, and to prepare for her coming here, my father taught himself to speak Japanese to prepare for her because he wanted to make sure that she was going to be comfortable coming here.
Your father did that?
Yes. Fast forward 32 years later to 1994, and the memorial that's down at the state capitol, Korean-Vietnam Memorial, it was a dedication ceremony, and I was asked to be on the planning committee to represent the families. For the dedication itself, they asked, would your mother come and lay the wreath to represent all the families? And I said, absolutely, I'm sure she would. So I brought my mother, and General Cockett was standing on my left, General Richardson on my right, both Hawaiian generals, very proud that she was standing there with the wreath. So the taps played. Then they did the flyover, or the missing man formation. So the three jets, and one flies off. Mm-hmm. So we're watching that. And as that jet flew off, a black bird flew in its place. And my mother looked at me, but this time with a smile, and she said, Kimo is here. Your brother is here.
Billy Gabriel says the ho'ailona of the blackbird also appeared at the dedication ceremony to honor her brother at the Gabriel Memorial Field at Fort Campbell, Kentucky in 2010. Also in 2010, Billy Gabriel would become part of the photo project that would make her feel closer to her late brother.
Call for Photos is part of a national project that was being launched in Washington, D.C. And the gentleman who founded the Vietnam Wall, Jan Scruggs, felt that he wanted to put a face to every name, 58,000 plus names engraved on the wall. He wanted to put a face and a picture because they were building an education center in Washington. And this education center would be for future generations to learn about the various wars that the United States has been involved. One room would be dedicated to Vietnam, and it would be called the Wall of Faces.
How many faces would there be?
58,000 plus. So Jan's vision was to put a face and a story to every name.
Billy Gabriel spent much of her professional career as a fundraiser who coordinated and publicized events such as the Kapi'olani Children's Miracle Network Telethon and the Easter Seals Taste of Honolulu fundraiser. In 2010, she answered the call to spearhead what she considers the most important project of her life, tracking down the photos of 276 Hawaii soldiers who never came home from the Vietnam War. Completing the Hawaii Call for Photos project would take several years.
I decided, okay, here's where the PR skills come in. Here's why networking with friends. So I contacted the various stations and Honolulu Star Advertiser. And I went to see the president then, Dennis Francis, and he's one of those who's accustomed to me knocking on the door for money, and he says, "Okay, Gabriel, what do you need this time?" And I said, something very simple, and I put the list on his desk. And he says, "Well, what is this?" I said, "Here's a list of 276 men who were killed in Vietnam. They're all from Hawaii. I need to find their pictures." He said, "Okay, so what is it that you want me to do?" I said, "I'd like you to publish their names in paper and state that I am searching for their photos, and if you have a photo, to contact me." And he says, I'd like a full page ad. So he said, this is about your brother. And I said, "You know, it's not just about my brother. He's one of the 276. It's about all the families and all of these young men, and it's a project that we need to make sure that we put a face to every name that's engraved on the wall in Washington."
So you ended up speaking with many of these family members.
I did.
That must have been, I can't imagine the emotion involved in those calls.
Heart-wrenching. Yes, yes. One man called me and just berated me for 5 minutes on the phone. "How dare you? How dare you publish these names of all our men who died in Vietnam in a stupid war?" And then he said, "My nephew was 19 when he enlisted." So I thought, okay, this is a family member. I can understand now why he is so emotional. And he says, "That boy, Poho, his life. He's going over there to fight for people he doesn't even know. Why?" You know, and then so I told him, "Uncle, I know how you feel because my brother also died in the war. He was the first Hawaiian boy." And his voice changed, and he says, "Oh, you local girl?" And I said, "Yes, I'm from here." And he says, "Oh, I saw the article in the paper. I thought I was calling Washington, somebody in Washington, D.C. I said, "Oh, no, no, this project is for here. And I'm trying to find all the pictures so that we can honor them." So he did send the picture in. But that's when I understood that this project was bigger than just finding the pictures. I became an umeke, a bowl, for many of these families to pour their emotions into. We cried together, we laughed together, you know, and we talked about our respected loved ones. But collectively, we knew that we had to stand by the fact that no matter which side of the fence you stood about the war, how you felt about it, we were here to see that our loved one would be honored for their courage, for the sacrifice they made, and that they would never be forgotten. That was our bond.
And you could come together over
that. We could come together on that, yes. They soon became family to me. Some of them called and said, I just want to meet you just to hug you, to say thank you. But it just allowed so many people to have a voice and to finally say what they've been wanting to say for 50 years.
Through the efforts of Billy Gabriel and many others who lost loved ones to the Vietnam War, Hawaii became the 8th state to locate all of the photos for its section of the Call for Photos project. Billy says she'll continue to honor the memory of her brother, James Kimo Gabriel Jr., and all the soldiers who are casualties of the Vietnam War. She's working on new memorial projects with Hawaii high schools. Mahalo to Billy Gabriel of Honolulu for sharing your story with us. And thank you for joining us. For PBS Hawaii and Long Story Short, I'm Leslie Wilcox. Aloha a hui ho.
For audio and written transcripts of all episodes of Long Story Short with Leslie Wilcox, visit pbshawaii.org. To download free podcasts of Long Story Short with Leslie Wilcox, go to the Apple iTunes Store or visit pbshawaii.org.
I was invited to go to Washington, D.C. for Memorial Day to represent the state.
When was this?
In laying the wreath. My mother told me whenever you're on sacred ground to remove your shoes. Then President Obama, I had a chance to meet, and he says, I know who you are. He says, as soon as I saw you standing there with bare feet, I knew you were a local girl. And he just started laughing.